Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network. We are here today doing our regular Military Monday show, though it's hardly going to be regular in terms of the content. It is no secret to close friends of mine that there were some periods of my early career as a consultant for the military that I worked in certain classified and clandestine areas. And one of them was up at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada, north of Las Vegas. And as part of the myth and legend and reality that I worked in and lived in for some years there, there was always the specter and knowledge that north of Las Vegas, north of Nellis, was a very special place. It went by many names. Area 51 being always a popular one in popular culture. Another being Dreamland, Watertown Ranch, and the Watertown Strip. It also had an official name, which only was revealed much, much later, that being of Groom Lake Air Force Base, situated on one of the largest naturally occurring dry lakes in the United States. Groom Air Force Base provides America with a clandestine area where they can go and test new aircraft, new ideas, new designs for aircraft. And today we have a very special guest. Bill Yenny is, much like myself, an aviation historian, an author. He comes to us today from those wonderful people at Zenith Press who give us so many great shows. And we're going to be talking about his new book, which is a lavishly illustrated 192-page volume called Area 51 Black Jets. So let's bring Bill on with us. And Bill, are you there, sir?
I am here.
My apologies for the dropping of calls and other things, but I think we're locked in now.
So far, so good. Yeah, there was a strange thing hovering over the house just a minute ago, and I think that might have had something to do with it.
Black helicopter or UFO?
I'm not permitted to say.
Indeed. Although both of those things have great association in the public mind with Area 51. Let's talk about you for a second. What is your background and what got you writing books?
Well, that's a good question. I was one of those little kids that was interested in airplanes when back in the long ago, and As time went on, I had an opportunity to author a book, and it turned out pretty well. And for that reason, I was given an opportunity to do another one, and so I was able to bring to life this interest that I have in aviation, and frankly, in a lot of other things. And so it just sort of grew organically from there.
I know that you did one book on a topic we've actually covered with a previous guest, my good friend Bob Doerr, which was Big Week some 70 years ago. What other books have you done prior to the Black Jets book?
Well, I've done recent books include a biography of Hap Arnold. Your Air Force listeners will will know him. I did a recent book for Zenith on the B-52, and so those are a couple of my recent books. I got a new book out on the Imperial Japanese Army that your World War II friends will want to see. I did a dual biography of Dick Bong and Tommy McGuire, who are the two top-scoring American aces of World War II. And I did a book about Lilya Litvak, who was the highest-scoring female ARAs of all time. She was another World War II fighter pilot. Beg your pardon?
You did that book.
I did.
Yeah, it's been widely used by a number of people I know, including my best friend Mike Markowitz in some of the magazine writing he's done, and I know Raina Pennington, who is something of a wellspring of knowledge on Soviet aviation, has thought well of your work. What got you involved with the whole idea of a Area 51 book?
Well, the idea of Area 51 came out of having written a lot about the aircraft that sort of flew out of there. I've written histories of post-war air operations, history of the Air Force, where I've touched on all of these various aircraft. I did a history of Lockheed some years ago. And everything keeps coming back to Area 51. It's not only the real airplanes that are there, but it's this sort of cloak of mystery, this unshakable overcoat of intrigue about the place that the idea that there is so much more there than meets the eye, but that this place is so firmly rooted in reality, despite the myth. So it was aviation history meets folklore, I guess is the best way to describe it.
And we'll definitely talk a little about the myth and legend that goes with this at the end of the show. But let's talk about the beginning. Obviously, Groom Lake is a lake only for a very short time every year during the annual rainy season, which lasts days. But
yeah.
The result is it all dries out into an absolutely flat, perfectly smooth, salted runway.
There are a number of these things all over the West. Edwards Air Force Base is built on one, and there are quite a few in the Nevada desert. If you do fly over that area, and I know that you have, you see a lot of them. And this one was located in sort of in the center, pretty much the dead center of the Nellis Range, which for listeners who don't know about that, it's a closed off, restricted airspace for military operations that is, it's almost as big as New England in this huge area of desert north of Las Vegas. And the whole story of how Groom Lake became famous started with get this conspiratorial fun. It started with the CIA, who wanted a secret airplane to fly over the Soviet Union and spy on their ICBM testing. And they contracted with Lockheed to build this airplane that could do that. And in order to test this airplane in a place where nobody could see it, Kelly Johnson, who ran the Advanced Developments Department of Lockheed, known as the Skunk Works, he and his guys searched all over the desert west looking for a place, found Groom Lake, landed there, Kelly looked around and he said, "This is the place." And from that moment forward, it became the secret aircraft development site that it is today.
And one of the key figures, along with Kelly Johnson, of course, was his chief test pilot of the day, the beloved Tony LeVere. Talk a little bit about his contribution to the process of building it up.
Well, he was the guy who actually flew the planes, and he flew a lot of planes. He was the Skunk Works test pilot going back to the days of the P-80, America's first jet fighter, and he was to the cockpit what Kelly Johnson was to the drawing board. And this the time frame here is the late 40s and all through the 50s, and so he was the guy in the cockpit. Kelly Johnson was the guy with the slide rule, and together they developed this amazing series of fantastic airplanes.
And, you know, Tony was obviously the first of a string of amazing test pilots that Kelly and his successors have used. Now, the U-2 was essentially a jet-powered glider. It was not a combat aircraft by any measure. It, in fact, was downright delicate. It was very, very easy to obviously go and fly a little too fast and tear the wings off, or fly a little too slow and stall the aircraft out and go into an unrecoverable stall. Yes.
Yeah, the idea of the U-2 was to take a jet fighter. The thing sort of had its roots in the F-104, although it's hard to see that unless you look at the two of them side by side. But as you pointed out, the idea was to put very long wings on it so that it could function like a glider, and that it could fly higher than any other airplane flying, because they wanted to fly across the Soviet Union. They wanted to have something that could not be intercepted by Soviet fighters or shot down by Soviet missiles, and also something that could fly extremely long distances. They would launch these things from Pakistan. They'd fly across the midsection of the Soviet Union, recover in Norway, and fly so high that the Soviets couldn't touch them. And but they were slow, and they were, as it turns out, vulnerable. And a couple of things to mention about this, the U-2. One thing being that because they flew so high, they were the source of a lot of the reports by airline pilots in the 50s of UFOs. I mean, they were literally UFOs. They were flying objects that were unidentifiable because they were flying at a higher altitude than most pilots realized airplanes could fly. And so that was one of their strengths. The weakness in the U-2 was illustrated by that infamous incident on May Day in 1960 when Frank Powers was flying over the midsection of the Soviet Union, and a SAM missile took him out, and that became the thing that brought the U-2 out of the closet, out of the darkness where it had been, and it drove the CIA back to Kelly Johnson, saying, "We like your long range, we like your high altitude, but we need something that's a little faster." And Kelly Johnson, in turn, gave him the fastest family of air-breathing airplanes that ever flew, and that leads to the next of the long line of aircraft that were developed and flight tested and eventually based by the CIA out at Groom Lake.
Now, one of the aspects that has been part of Groom Lake in myth, in legend, and reality is that this is a place that nobody gets to take a tour of, that this place is perhaps one of the most classified facilities, not just in the U.S., but in the world. Talk a little bit about the early security that the CIA, Air Force, and Lockheed used to keep the eyes of the world off of Groom Lake and at the same time kept the products of their work clandestine.
Well, it was, as we were talking earlier, it was in the middle of nowhere. There were no paved roads that led to it. It was well guarded that way. It was also beneath this enormous blanket of restricted airspace. And if you look at a map of the Nellis Range, and here I'll plug my book because there I do.
Please
have,
do shamelessly plug.
Shamelessly plug. Well, I will say that that I can practically guarantee that you will find more and better maps of that whole area collected in one place in this book, more so than anywhere else. So that's one selling point for the book. But,
and who is the talented artist who rendered those maps?
Well, the one that shows the entire Groom Lake area, the entire Nellis Range area from the California border to north of Tonopah, that was myself who drew that one. The others are vintage FAA maps.
Fair enough, and. Is it not true that one of the big ways that they hid this was that they stuck it right next to the test range where the Atomic Energy Commission and its successor, the Department of Energy, tested nuclear weapons?
Yes, part of that's another slice of this huge area of desert that's covered by restricted airspace is the Nevada test range. And it's in the sort of the lower left-hand corner of the entire test range, and the Groom Lake restricted airspace area is sort of at the upper right-hand corner of that, in the dead center of the whole Nellis Range. And throughout the years, this little square of that centers on Groom Lake was so restricted that even the military pilots who were operating routinely in the Nellis Range airspace were forbidden from flying over that, and in fact they were even ordered not to look in that direction when they were flying near it. That was how restricted it was, and for that reason, it came to be known as Dreamland. Pilots in the and as you probably know, having worked at Nellis, that's what pilots called it because it was this sort of magical, weird place. And
oh yeah, I was up there in the early '80s, and God forbid a crew doing one of the red flag operations that they run up there regularly, mistakenly one way or the other, overfly that airspace because they will be intercepted, they will be forced down, and they will be talked to very severely. And if they're lucky, they will get to stay in the service. I mean, it's overflying Groom Lake is a no-no. In a big way. And it's here that I believe that, as it was explained to me, the Area 51 moniker came from the fact that the Department of Energy originally laid out the test range for nuclear testing into different areas, and this one just happened to be number 51.
Yeah, that's one theory. It is there's only a tiny corner of the Atomic Energy Commission range that intersects the Groom Lake Dreamland Square, and the best guess scenario is that it was part of that administrative organizing of areas. And nothing more sinister than that, but the fact that it was classified, that the area was classified, the designation of it as 51 remained classified.
So if you're working there, how do you get there?
Well, how do you get there? Well, a lot of people fly to Las Vegas. They land at McCarran Airport and they look out the window at all of the plane as they touch down at all those glittering casinos. And as they do so, they hardly notice this unmarked building at the northwest corner of McCarran Airport, and they hardly notice the white unmarked 737s that are parked around this unmarked building. And that's Janet Airlines. And Janet takes off many times a day, regular flights. They fly right over downtown Las Vegas in their unmarked airplanes, and they fly north, and they land at Groom Lake, and that's how the people commute in. There are, like I said,
also,
there are no paved roads.
Yeah. Now there are dirt roads, and occasionally there are sightings of a mysterious white bus.
Yeah. Yes. It's hardly mysterious. It makes itself very, very evident to you. There is up there around milepost 29 on the. On the extraterrestrial highway, Highway 375, about 2.5 hours or so north of Las Vegas, there you come to an unmarked road, and it's a gravel road, and it's probably the best gravel road you've ever driven on, and it is dead straight, and you come over the pass. Coming westward from having turned off of Highway 93, and you come over the pass and you look down and you see that gravel road cutting across the Nevada desert. And I don't know about you, but the first thing that popped into my head was the Nazca lines down in Peru, you know, the famous prehistoric artifacts down there that Eric Von Daniken made famous in his Chariots of the Gods franchise back in the 70s. Just a straight line cutting in across 13 miles of the Nevada desert. And you get to that road, there are no signs. You make a left, you drive down that road. It's the best gravel road you've ever driven on. You can set your cruise control at about 45 and just go straight. And you go straight, and then the road starts to curve, and you start to notice on the hillsides these antennas, and they're listening to you, and they're watching you, and you come around a couple of bends, and I saw it on your website this morning. You got pictures of that bank of signs that you come to.
Oh, yeah, and the mysterious white gate.
And up on the hill, yes, you do see a white van, and you see a couple of fellas with binoculars, and they're not watching the birds. They're watching you. And you notice that just past that those signs is a beautiful paved road. The gravel road ends and becomes paved, but at that point, you drive on asphalt, you wind up with your face on the asphalt and a M16 in the back of your neck. That you dare not go further than that sign.
Security is, to put it mildly, aggressive at that end of the range.
Yeah, people who have tried to climb up on the hills around there and look across at Groom Lake have had very, very bad experiences, and not something to be taken lightly. And I certainly do not recommend any mountain climbing there, because you'll literally trip over tripwires getting up those hills. And they're not nice to people, and they do send the helicopters out to pick you up.
Not something anybody wants to do. Now, obviously, you had a couple of generations of Lockheed aircraft that were developed and tested through the 50s and 60s. The Blackbird line, starting with the CIA A-12, moving on to a fighter version, the YF-12 for the Air Force, and later a two-seat version of the Blackbird, best known as the SR-71.
Go ahead.
There even was a drone called the D-21 that evolved from it.
Yes. Well, as I was saying earlier, the loss of the U-2 led to the CIA asking Kelly Johnson to build me something that's a lot faster, and they did, and that was the A-12. It was the there were 11 A's before that that were all design studies. A-12 was determined to be the best of the lot, and it went into production. The A stands for Archangel, which was the Lockheed identification designation for that program. The CIA, showing their sense of humor, called this thing Oxcart. So Oxcart was their code name for the fastest airplane that had ever existed. And this program, as you pointed out, evolved into there was a fighter variant, which was short-lived, never reached operational status. But then it evolved into the famous SR-71 Blackbird, which was somewhat larger, but identical in appearance, mainly, and which is sort of everybody's favorite airplane. If you like something that's really fast and really high-flying and pushes the edge of the envelope in every direction, fantastic airplane, absolutely legendary. And that all evolved out of this next phase of development at the Skunk Works. You mentioned the D-21 drone. Go ahead.
And all of these Blackbirds, including the D-21, had certain common elements, not the least of which is they were very fast. They flew very high, on the order of 85,000 feet plus. They, and speed-wise, Mach 3 plus. They were built almost entirely of titanium, which was brand new and very difficult to formulate. And last and maybe most leastly publicized, they were the first stealthy airplanes.
They were, they were stealthy in ways that aeronautical engineers didn't really understand at the time. But it was the blending of the fuselage, the way the lines of the airplane were not right angles. There are no right angles in the airplane. So there were a lot of elements that later were discovered to be stealthy. they did it, Kelly Johnson and his crew did it for aerodynamic reasons, but it worked out that the thing was stealthy. But the best thing that you could say about the SR-71 was that it didn't really need to be stealthy because it could outrun anything. And I remember the SR-71 drivers used to describe themselves as sled drivers, but they used to wear those Mach 3 plus patches, and they to chuckle when they mentioned Mach 3 plus, because the plus indicated a speed that was much, much faster than Mach 3.
Yeah. Now, beginning in the late 1960s, America was obviously involved in the Vietnam War, and one of the priorities that the Air Force took upon itself was that after they started getting beaten up by the Soviet-supplied MiGs that the North Vietnamese Air Force flew, they really wanted to get a look and fly Russian MiGs. And beginning in the late 60s, they began to acquire a small fleet of these. Initially, they picked up a MiG-21 that the Israelis had seduced out of Iraq. MiG-17s began to show up, and later MiG-19s. Talk a little bit about have rivet, have drill, and have donut.
Well, those were all designations for various MiG programs, and as the U.S. Air Force started gathering these things, it wasn't the idea wasn't just to get them and study them and look them over and take them apart and put them back together again. They wanted to fly these things. And they wanted American pilots who would have to meet them in combat. They wanted these American pilots to have the experience of flying against them. You could take a couple of F-4s and you could dogfight all day, but an F-4 does not behave like a MiG-21. So having a MiG-21 to actually dogfight against was considered to be immensely valuable and ultimately proved to be so. And so they started to collect these MiGs and what to do with them. We don't want the other side to know that we've got them or to know that what we're doing with them. So it was back out to the Nevada desert. And if Area 51, Groom Lake, was the middle of nowhere, there was another field near the little town of Tonopah that it was at the far edges of nowhere. And so this field near Tonopah became the home to these MiGs. And there were MiG-17s, as you say, MiG-19s, and then the MiG-21s arrived, and eventually they were able to build an entire squadron out of this collection, and this squadron then became the secret enemy against which pilots flying in the Red Flag exercises would meet and fly against. They called it Red Flag because the idea was that American pilots were going to go out into that restricted airspace and they were going to fight against other aircraft. And they had a squadron of American aircraft as well that were painted up to look like Soviet aircraft and fly Soviet-style tactics. They were going to do that.
So the F-5s of the 64th and 65th Squadron actually based down at Nellis. Yes.
Yeah, they were based at Nellis, not exactly in an open knowledge thing, but it was an open secret that they had those, and they were based at Nellis, and they flew in the Red Flag exercises. But it was sort of, as you went through the red flag, it was sort of like going to school, you know. You go through, you know, the freshmen and the sophomores, they all flew against these aggressors that were American planes painted up to look like Soviet bloc aircraft. But once you progressed to a certain point in red flag, once you got to be a junior and then a senior, you'd go out there and you'd be waiting for those, and all of a sudden, here would come a real MiG.
As we called them in the day, one of the places I worked out there was a place called the Threat Training Facility, which is essentially a petting zoo of Soviet-style equipment. And we had, in locked rooms, you had to have a clearance. You couldn't be anything but a U.S. senator, citizen, and they really, I was one of the only half dozen or so contractors that ever got to see the inside of it at the time. But we had cast off MiGs from those squadrons, ones that had been bent or had been used for spare parts. And this allowed those same pilots who had just had the shock of seeing the real deal up in the air to come down, sit down in the pilot's seat of these things, and spend a little time doing touchy-feely with the real deal.
Yep. And that was something that at the height of the Cold War was very, very classified, something that was kept very much secret.
And, again, more flights by what was then called Transamerica Airlines. The Transamerica Corporation had the contract to fly them, which eventually became Janet. And it was just an incredibly busy flow of planes and buses north and south. I mean, the one thing you did not want to be is anywhere near the terminals of those vehicles and aircraft early on a Monday morning or late on a Friday evening.
Commute hours.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we're going to talk a little more about what happened after that here in a minute. We're going to have a couple of network messages, and we'll be talking when we get back with Bill Yenny of the Zenith Publishing Group and his book, Area 51, Black Jets.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Rightstream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Rightstream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Rightstream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to Rightstream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the Rightstream Radio Network.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorists, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, we wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. So we owe them a lot.
We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can, but we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives. And for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. What a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And welcome back, listeners. This is Military Monday on the Right Stream Radio Network. I am your host, John Gresham. And today we are talking to Bill Yenny, who is the author of the Zenith Press book, Area 51 Black Jets. Are you still with us, Bill?
Yes, I am.
Ah, the wonders of technology. It is lovely to live on the bleeding edge. And speaking of the bleeding edge, let's talk about the next phase of what happened out at Groom Lake in the 1970s and 80s. And specifically, let's talk a little bit about what the results of the Vietnam War and the Yom Kippur War made the Air Force do. And this is obviously the story of stealth.
Well, you can take the story back to where we started with the U-2. They needed something that could fly higher and farther. That indicated that maybe we also needed something that could fly faster. And so each one of these steps leads to something with a little bit greater or a significantly greater capability. So you had the Skunk Works giving the CIA and then the Air Force the fastest airplane ever, but still visible on radar, these planes. What you found in the Yom Kippur War and in Vietnam was you had pilots having to operate in some of the densest air defense concentrations in the world, and doesn't matter how fast you're flying or how far you can fly or how high you can fly if they can see you coming. And so the conundrum was to develop something that was invisible to radar. And that became the quest for stealth technology. And this technology was finally developed by Lockheed. As it turned out, it was not the Skunk Works, but another side of Lockheed. But that's a long story. But it was Lockheed, and by the late 70s, they were developing a flying demonstrator of this stealth technology. It was not what a lot of people expected. A lot of people assumed that, okay, you get away from the right angles, you make the thing as smooth as possible, as blended, curved edges. No, it turned out to be irregular facets, flat facets on the surface. Very strange. And Kelly Johnson himself said that thing isn't aerodynamic. It can't fly, but it did, and that thing was the Hev Blue demonstrator. Once again, they needed some place to test this thing because they couldn't. They built it at Burbank, but they couldn't very well fly it from Burbank. They couldn't very well take it out to Edwards Air Force Base where NASA was, and the world could see everything that was going on. So where did they go? They went back to the Nevada desert, and they went out to Tonopah, where they had a nice long runway that was used to hosting these operational MiGs, but it was invisible from the outside world, and that became the development center for this strange thing called Hev Blue. And Hev Blue evolved over time into the operational F-117 stealth fighter. And in fact, this stealth fighter, the F-117, was based out at Tonopah, just as the old CIA A-12s had been operationally based out at Groom Lake a couple of decades before. And this thing was extremely secret right up until the first Gulf War, when they spearheaded the first attacks on Saddam Hussein's air defenses, and the rest is history.
Now, sadly, we don't have one of the Hev Blue prototypes. There were two of them for museum purposes today. Sadly, both aircraft were lost as a result of flight test accidents. But in spite of that, obviously, the technology was promising enough that Lockheed got a contract to go ahead and build a full wing of these aircraft known as F-117 Nighthawks. There also at the time was another stealthy prototype being tested out there. A little odd-looking thing from Northrop Grumman, nicknamed the Whale, but in fact called Tacit Blue. And what was it?
Well, Tacit Blue was it was your readers who are, or listeners who are familiar with aircraft technology and aviation history will be familiar with Joint Stars, which was essentially an airborne command and control platform that could, like AWACS, which monitors enemy aircraft and vectors friendly aircraft to intercept them and fight them. Joint Stars, before that, the Tacit Blue was designed to do the same thing on the ground. So this was an airborne platform that could track opposing forces on the ground. And what made Tacit Blue unique was its appearance. So you've got these things like the SR-71 that you know, frankly, it looks like a cool airplane. It looks like a dart, and it looks fast. It looks exciting. F-117 looks black and sinister and menacing, like the kind of thing that might fly out of a Hollywood CGI studio. Tacit Blue looked like a milk carton with little stubby wings sticking out of the side. It was the most ungainly, ugly, unlikely airplane imaginable. But what I find the most fascinating about Tacit Blue was that it flew its entire test program, numerous flights over a long period of time, test flights for many flights over through that restricted airspace, finished its test program, landed at Groom Lake, taxied into the hangar, hangar door closed, and nobody knew about it. Nobody who was out there like you and I speculating in the aviation enthusiast press about it, about mysterious airplanes, nobody knew about this. There was no speculation that they were flying some ugly thing that looked like a milk carton out at Groom Lake. Nobody knew about it. They kept it completely secret until they decided to make an announcement, one of those, oh, by the way, announcements. And I find that fascinating because it really leads into this whole world of speculating about if they had all those things, what do they got out there now?
Yeah, and just what the hell are they doing out there?
Yeah, but Tacit Blue tells you that what they're doing out there is anything they want to, and you don't know about it. That is what Tacit Blue illustrates for me.
And it's interesting that Tacit Blue actually resulted in two aircraft. One, the modified 707s that became the E-8 Joint Stars airplanes that today operate a wing down in Georgia. And then another airplane, which, because the Tacit Blue proved to be such a stealthy design, Northrop Grumman got a contract to build something called the B-2 Spirit because of it.
Yes, the B-2 Spirit was our famous stealth bomber, and that's another whole topic of conversation. But it's definitely one of the poster children for extremely advanced airplanes that look really, really unusually strange.
And probably the subject of another book for one or more of us, one or both of us in the future, obviously.
Obviously. The story of the B-2 bomber is something we could spend another hour on pretty easily.
Oh, probably more than that. Let's, though, talk about what little we know has been going on out there. We obviously know that after the development of the 117, which later, of course, moved out into the light at Holloman Air Force Base, we know that since those days in the late 1990s, business at Groom Lake has not stopped. That, in fact, if anything, they've actually increased the volume and pace of test operations there and at Tonopah, correct?
Absolutely, and it's frustrating for those of us on the outside who want to know what's going on in the inside. It's frustrating for us to speculate and wonder about that. As I like to describe it, it's like you're not seeing something directly, but you're seeing the shadow that it casts, and in that shadow, you see that there's something there, and you have bit of an idea of what it might look like, but a shadow tells you so little about the actual nature of the thing. And as you point out, we know it's going on. We just have a hard time knowing what is going on.
For example, there is a hint, and it may have been dropped intentionally for people like you and I to notice the hint, that there may have been, you know, there's always been the myth and legend about something called Aurora. Talk about Aurora, and does it exist? Can it exist?
Well, Aurora was one of those things, and talking about shadows, the shadow of Aurora was a just a single line in a budget document at the end of the 20th century, and it was said that there was a program, an aircraft program called Aurora. So everybody has been asking for years the question you just asked: what is Aurora? A lot of the speculation has centered on it being the amazingly fast successor to the SR-71, but nobody really knows. All we know is this shadow, and is the shadow a hypersonic successor to the SR-71, or is it deliberate and arguably playful misinformation? Nobody really knows.
And it needs to be said, the federal government is more than happy to go and be playful and treat the public interest in this area much as a tabby cat would treat a ball of yarn.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that you could even argue that the way the security guards treat the looky-loos is part of that playing to the myth, playing to the folklore of the people on the outside trying to get a peek under the edge of the circus tent. And again, it's the shadow. We can only speculate about these things. You know, we were earlier talking about off air. We were talking about the stealth Black Hawk, which was probably tested out there. There's other things like the RQ-170, the Beast of Kandahar, stealth drone that was shot down by the Iranians a while back, and has been seen operating from Kandahar in Afghanistan. You could ask rhetorically, how does that fit in with the Lockheed Polecat drone, a similar flying wing type drone that had flown, and we were told that the only one was lost in a crash. Is that true? Is it related to the Beast of Kandahar? There was a lot of talk about the son of Darkstar, the mysterious offspring of the fairly well known Darkstar drone that was a program that was supposedly canceled. These are just examples of some of the programs that have been discussed. There's the Boeing Phantom Ray program, which is actually being tested in the light at Edwards Air Force Base, but you know, is that part of another grander program? Just some little tidbits on the lunch tray of food for thought.
And we know that a couple of operational things have come out of this. As you mentioned, the RQ-170, and something that only showed up once and the public only got to see the tail section on, that being something that is known as the MH-60 Stealth Hawk, the two lead helicopters that were used on the bin Laden raid back in 2011.
Yes, that's another aspect of what's being done out there. Stealth modifications of existing aircraft. We don't know what aircraft they're modifying, and we only knew about the stealth Black Hawk because one cracked up and the pieces were still left the next day, and it was photographed for the world to see. It's like the same deal with the RQ-170. Probably wouldn't know very much about that if the Iranians hadn't shot one down and put it on their TV. Again, it's the shadows. We know about these things because we see a tail section here, wreckage of a crash there. Still, we go out to the Nevada desert and look up into the sky and look at the lights, and as I've done and as you've done, and you see those things, and you're, as the sun goes down, your imagination comes up, and you start looking at those lights in the sky and imagining what they could be and what they might be. And
well, I'm going to be one of those people who says, I haven't imagined it. I remember the night that I told you about out at Fort Irwin. I was at Drinkwater Lake.
Yes, you did.
And getting ready to watch a live fire exercise back in 1993. And all of a sudden, across the sky, coming from south to north, comes something that looks like a glowing pumpkin seed and going wah, 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 and heads north into the Nevada test range, and I was reaching for my camera to take a picture of it, and the public affairs officer there from Fort Irwin, he gently touched me and said, please don't shoot that. We get that all the time here. And just the attitude of the people who see this stuff all the time, it's just good to know that you're not crazy, at least not that crazy.
Yeah, there are. I've talked to a lot of people who have seen a lot of things, and I've seen a few things myself that you look at it and you shake your head, and you do ask yourself whether you're crazy, but then you look around and you see that the people around you are also shaking their heads and with mystification. You know, is it mass hypnosis, or did we really see that thing?
Yeah, we saw it. It's just always kind of weird when you shall we say nudge up against the Groom Lake phenomenon, and that leads us to our final segment where we talk about the myth and legend that has become Groom Lake and Area 51 over the years. There is, as a matter of course, an extremely public identification with this. The movie Independence Day, which clearly, you know, made the whole Area 51 motif a setting. And, of course, there have been other documentaries such, which have provided the public with at least some sort of notion that there is such a place. Talk a little bit about that phenomenology and that myth and legend, if you will.
Well, it goes back to Bob Lazar in the early 1990s when he let it be known that he had worked out there and that they had some extraterrestrial artifacts out there, and they were doing some reverse engineering, and that caught the attention of the public. We know enough about Groom Lake to know that if we did capture one of those things, or if we did find a crashed one somewhere, that Groom Lake would be the place we'd take it to reverse engineer it and ultimately to flight test it. So there was little leap of imagination required to think that if these things existed, that would be the place that they would go. But then this thing sort of took on a life of its own. You know, it was like when you look in the night sky and your imagination starts to take over. Or you see something like you described and like I've seen that really does push the limits of credibility. And this thing mushroomed into a whole folklore. There were the movies. There were the and with the advent of the internet, the obsessive blogging and this whole culture that has developed. And then there was even the state of Nevada that renamed Highway 375, which runs up the north and northeast side of the Nellis Range. They renamed 375 as the Extraterrestrial Highway. You go up there now and you turn onto that road and you can barely read the sign because so many people have put their bumper stickers and decals on it to show that they too have been here. And you take the Extraterrestrial Highway and you know that you're in the middle of nowhere because there is, after you turn off of Highway 93, there is nothing on that road. There is just
it
nothing.
Is just miles and miles of miles and miles.
And you come over the crest of the pass and you see the Groom Lake Road. And you come down off of the pass and you take the Groom Lake Road, or if you don't, you drive another couple of miles and there be the black mailbox, which has been the center of this whole Area 51 UFO folklore for the last 20 years. The black mailbox, which of course everybody will tell you in their second breath has been painted white, which actually happened in the 90s, but it's still called the black mailbox. But the exciting thing about it having been painted white is that it has become a bulletin board, a whiteboard for people to write messages. And one of the things that I found fascinating, and I photographed it for the book, are some of these messages that people have left and about having been there and what they saw. And I think the most poignant that was painted on it at the time that I was there last was that in large letters the phrase, "I want to believe." And I think that really summarizes this whole culture of people looking in from the outside. So you leave the black mailbox, you drive a little farther, and I saw that you had pictures on your site this morning of the Little Ailey Inn. The Little Ailey Inn is the only place on these hundreds of miles of nowhere that you can stop on Highway 375 and go in and get a cup of coffee. And because it's the only place, it's the place where everybody goes. Everybody.
And you said
that
the people there very quickly go into different factions.
Yes, that's right. You sit down in the Little Alien and you notice the people around you who are discussing this, and it's the only thing being discussed. That you might have a few people at the bar or a few people at this table over here. They're very much black aircraft buffs. They can tell you the X this and the XF that and the the have this and the tacit that, and they know all of that stuff, and they know all the speculative stuff, and they know all about these black airplanes. And then at the table across the room, you got the alien bus. And you get these people talking about the same phenomena, and they're very, very different interpretations of this phenomena. And it is the most amazing conversation imaginable. It's to hear the people who believe in aliens describing in minute detail what these things are and that they are not of this world. And to be debating the people across the room who know all of the minutiae of the most advanced aircraft in the world, and to hear them talking back and forth is one of the most fascinating experiences of the whole journey to the black mailbox and beyond.
So, there is a little industry for tourism. There still is one place you can hike, I think, to actually see the base that the U.S. government has not restricted, the mountaintop a little ways away. But Groom Lake and, to a lesser degree, Tonopah Test Range remain America's clandestine flight test centers.
Absolutely.
Is there any sense at all of what's going on up there? Because the one sense I get is that, if anything, it's busier and there's more going on than ever up there.
Well, you can sit next to the pool in Las Vegas and count the Janet flights going over, because they go right over the strip, which is such an amazing thing to me. You're sitting there watching these things in the sky, and you're surrounded by people who are utterly oblivious. I mean, their minds are so far away from what's going on right up above them that I just have to laugh. But you can sit there and watch these things fly over, and you can count them. And as you say, there are more than ever. So there is something going on up there, and well, there's probably many somethings going on up there, which is frustrating for people like you and I. But at the same time, it's exciting to know that stuff is up there, and it will be interesting to see over the coming years what little tidbits they will throw out to us.
And the one sense I get is that the activities are, as much as anything, no longer involving big aircraft programs as much as small technology demonstrators, including unmanned demonstrators. We know, for example, that there's been a lot of work on cruise missiles, precision weapons, and even unmanned helicopters.
Oh, yeah, I think that what you see in the white world has always sort of paralleled what's going on in the black world. What you see in this enormous move toward unmanned vehicles that has been ongoing in military aviation technology since the turn of the century, all of this has been paralleled by a similar series of developments in the on the dark side.
And I guess the next question is, how has your book been received? I mean, it's a beautifully it's just a beautifully put together book, like so many of the others that Zenith Press has been putting out over the past few months. What do people think of it?
Well, I have talked to a lot of people who own it, who've seen it, and everybody seems to like it. I think everybody seems to be pleased with it. I tried to be comprehensive in telling the complete story, telling the details of the programs that have become public knowledge, and at the same time pushing the limits of what the CIA and the Air Force have revealed about other programs up there. I tried to do all of that, again, as I said, to put in the maps that, and a lot of people have commented on the maps, that they appreciate that because there's this mystery about where is Area 51. And so I've tried to give them the what and where, and a lot of people have commented on that, and a lot of people have appreciated it. I've had a couple of people tell me that they're headed up there to the extraterrestrial highway because of what they read in the book and how their appetite has been whetted for a real hands-on experience with the black mailbox. So I'm really pleased with the response that I've been getting.
And I guess that takes us to the question, what are you doing next?
Well, I'm actually working on several projects related to World War II technology and World War II history and World War II operations, and which I was working this morning and thinking about some things that I was writing and. Oh, there are still secrets from that era that to be revealed, threads to be drawn between things that are little known, and I guess that's a very intriguing part of writing about history, is to bring little known facts into the light, and to tell the stories of things that, oh, for example, that you and I might know inside and out, but the general public is unaware.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on today, despite the technical problems we've been dealing with over the weekend with our hosting service, and telling us and our listeners just a wonderful set of stories.
Well,
please go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to you thank me. I was going to thank you. I'm very, very feel very privileged to be on with you and to have a chance to chat.
Well, I hope we have reason to have you back on someday. And please be well. And thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, sir.
Take care.
And you too, and
with that, we have come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. I will tell you that if everything goes right, next Monday we will have our old friend Barrett Tillman on to talk about his new history of the forgotten but very important 15th Air Force, which operated in the Mediterranean. And until then, have a great week. Be safe and well. And please come back and join us again next week for Military Monday.
What's a flat in a pawn shop? to me. I saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. Never cry. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man. What's a song to a dead man to me? I never loved a soldier until the world's a war. I thought about tomorrow till my baby hit the floor. I only talk to God when somebody's about to die. Never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. You can cry for her, die for her, lay down your life for her, kiss and wave goodbye to her. Anything at all. You can cry for her, die for her. There's a baby on the doorstep, wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flag to a pawn shop. Upon the may he forget why he is crying so dead.